Well, this is one of the odder Sundays in some ways in the church year, because it's one of the odder things that happens in the Bible. There are some people who tell you that everything in the Bible is kind of odd, but they just haven't looked at it carefully. But this is the Sunday where we remember the baptism of Jesus. And when we think of the baptism of Jesus, I think we are allowed to be just as, I don't know if confused is the right word, but at least as a little baffled as John was. And I've occasionally wondered what was going through John's head. Like, that must have been the strangest thing he'd ever had to even consider. I mean, John knew who Jesus was. He'd been gifted by the Holy Spirit to know what was happening, to know who he was related to, because of course he was, and to know who he was about to baptize. And you can see why it made no sense to him whatsoever. Why would I baptize you? You should baptize me if anything's going on. And yet, Jesus says, depending on your translation, let it be so now, it is proper for us to do this to fulfill all righteousness, which really doesn't help a lot. At least it doesn't help me a lot. I'm not entirely sure what goes on there. That just sort of says, well, we're doing this because we're supposed to. Which, sometimes that's the only answer you get. I didn't find it satisfying as a small child any more than my children do, that just do this because you need to. We want to know more. And as I was thinking about this, getting ready for this Sunday, our Acts reading is, I think, what gave me another way to think about it. And I'm sure this has crossed my mind at least once or twice before, but it struck me a little more significantly this year for whatever reason. And I think it's because I was reading the Acts passage, first of all, in a different translation. I've read it before, but it was the New Revised Standard Version. The New International Version, which I have before me, which is slightly different than what Gene read, says, "Then Peter began to speak. I now realize how true it is that God does not show favoritism." The New Revised Standard Version says that Peter says, "I now realize that God does not show partiality." And that got me thinking, and that's where the sermon title comes from. No partiality means no partiality, period. I mean, as soon as you make that statement that there's no partiality or no favoritism, you're kind of stuck, because it's an all or nothing deal. And if God says there's no partiality, then there isn't any. So if Peter can talk about how God shows no partiality, then this baptism makes a little bit more sense, because then how could Jesus not be baptized? One of the things that I always tried to do when I had people reporting to me, when I had employees or people I was supervising, is I wanted to create this environment, this atmosphere, where they knew that I wasn't going to ask them to do something that I simply wouldn't, because it was too messy, it was too trivial, it was too embarrassing, whatever it might be. Because there's almost nothing that aggravates us more than somebody who says, "I want you to go and do this thing that I'm not willing to do myself." There's just something in us, at least most of us, maybe some of you are at a further degree of development than I am, but that just instantly makes me bridle. And I just think, wait a second. You want me to do something that you're not willing to do yourself. Why? Well, and maybe there's good reasons, maybe there aren't. I tend to think there can't be a good reason. And that doesn't mean, and in some ways the tricky part isn't so much that you have to see the person who asked you to do this do everything before you do it, but you have to be convinced, completely convinced, that they will if they need to. And there's really only one way to convince people that you will do that, and that's to do it, at least now and then. One of my jobs when I worked at Canadian Bible College and the seminary was I was head of enrollment. We called it enrollment because we couldn't find a single person under the age of 30 who had a positive connection with the word recruitment, which is what we did. We tried to get students. And we did that primarily over the phone. We would interact with youth pastors who sent names to us, or people would fill out a form somewhere and say they had some interest, and then we would phone them. Well, cold calling people, even those who have expressed some kind of interest, so they're sort of cool calling rather than cold calling, can be a really challenging job. And so we hired students, because that's who students want to talk to. Now, they did a number of surveys, and they laid out, there's 11 sort of identifiable groups who might contact a prospective student. Number one that they want to be contacted by is a current student. Number two is a former student. The absolute dead last was somebody like me, who got paid to be recruitment, because they said, and this was a much wider survey than Bible colleges and such, but the impression is that those people are paid to lie to you and make you come to their school, so they didn't want to talk to me at all. And so I had a great out to get away from not having to talk to people, because, you know, it is a bit of a challenge. And, you know, people ask you questions you can't answer, and they don't want to talk to you on the phone. This is a number of years ago, before many people had given up on talking to the phone at all. I mean, when was the last time you saw somebody talking on their cell phone? Nobody uses it to talk anymore. They just text people and things. But back then, talking was on the phone was still happened. And whenever we had new staff come on, new students, they would watch and listen to other people phone. And I made sure that I was one of the people doing the phoning. Not because I particularly wanted to, although I was okay with that, but because they needed to see me do that kind of thing. They needed to know that I understood what they were going through. Because that's the thing that drives us crazy. When somebody says, go and do this thing that I won't. It's because we're pretty sure, and sometimes I think we're right, that they don't even know what they're asking us to do, really. I mean, they know the outcome. They know what they want us to accomplish. But they've never done it. So they don't know how hard it is. They don't know what the challenges are. They don't understand. People who don't understand and ask you to do something can be really frustrating. Because how do they judge whether you're doing it well? How do they know whether you're doing it in as efficient a way as possible? If you're having a problem, how can you go to them and ask them how to do it better when they've never done it themselves? All of us, I suspect, have had bosses or even fellow worker, co-workers who are giving us direction what we need to do, who have done this to us. He said, go and do this thing, and it's really, really hard. And they come by and they don't say, wow, that looks really hard. They say, why aren't you done yet? One of my first jobs where I wasn't working for a family member was on the grounds department at the University of Alberta Hospital. The supervisor of the grounds department was father of a friend of mine, so there's still a connection, but it was the first time I was sort of out in the real world. I was in high school working in the summer. And one of my first jobs was to dig up this little bit of dirt. There's a corner that everybody cut. And so rather than trying to convince people to stop walking through this flower bed, because it just wasn't going to happen, we're going to dig up that part of the dirt, and we were then just going to put in gravel, you know, so people could walk on it, so it was easier to deal with, and we wouldn't be frustrated with them. And so they gave me a spade and said, there, go dig that up. It was like digging this. It had been walked on for probably 2 or 3 years. It was about as close to cement as you could get. I was whatever age I was, 16, I suppose, weighed maybe 140 pounds. Had never used a spade because there's a lot of technique to using a spade that'll make your life a lot easier. But at the beginning, you're trying brute force, and you're trying to brute force your way through a paving block is what it was like. And it took, well, I can't remember how long the whole job took, but I worked away at it all morning. And there's this little tiny bit gone. I'm feeling a little ashamed. One of my coworkers comes by and goes, why aren't you done yet? So I'm feeling even worse. My boss's boss, like the head of the whole grounds department, and the fact that he was a friend of mine was not going to save me the edge of his tongue if it was so necessary. He came up and he said, oh, you're not done. So let me see that. So he took the spade and he dug out a little bit more. He said, this is terrible. This is going to take you days. you've made a good start. And I think you can do this. You just keep going at it. And I said, well, Wayne was giving me a hard time. I said, well, you tell him to come and do it then. You tell him that I said he should come and try it for a little while and see how hard this is. Of those two people, the coworker and my ultimate boss there, who do you think I was going to listen to? And who do you think I would do anything for? Well, of course it was my boss. Of course it was John. Because he looked at it and he took a little bit of, and he went into it enough that he then understood. If he would have taken the spade and dug out twice as much as I did in 2 minutes, well, then, you know, that might have been different. But he looked and said, this is really hard. This is a hard job. I know you can do it, so I got a bit of encouragement too. He said, let me know when you're done. Wayne, who just looked at it as digging up some dirt, just said, well, aren't you done yet? We want to respond to people who understand what we're going through. Paul told the people he was preaching to that God shows no partiality. The point he was making is that the message of God was no longer just for the Jews, it was for everybody. But part of what comes into that is a different kind of understanding that we have now with God, because God became flesh and dwelt among us. Jesus came and lived the life we're living. And it's not too much of a stretch. It's not any stretch at all, really, to look at where Peter says that God doesn't show partiality, to realize that God didn't show partiality to Jesus either. We get baptized for all kinds of reasons. There's many reasons for baptizing our children, or if we get baptized as older people. There's many reasons, all of which are fine. There's no single right reason. There's lots of things that push us in that direction. But often one of the ones that comes up is it's an explicit identification of ourselves with God and with God's purposes on earth. Jesus didn't need to do that. He was God on earth. We often get baptized, and you hear people who get baptized as adults, if they give a little bit of a statement, often saying that this is their public renunciation of sin. Not that they say they're going to be perfect from this point on, but they're publicly saying they are stepping away from that other. Jesus didn't have to do that. He committed no sin. So was Jesus' baptism pointless? No, it wasn't pointless. What it was Jesus saying, this is something that needs to be done by all of you, and I'm going to do it too. The people we follow, the people we respect, are not those who have worked out the theory of what we're supposed to do next, but the people who have done what we're supposed to do next and have said you should do this too. We follow guides who have gone where we want to go. We don't follow guides who have read about it in a book. A guide is someone who has gone there before and helps us get there. When Jesus said, I'm going to be baptized that all righteousness might be fulfilled, he wasn't saying that I am somehow unrighteous and baptism will fix that. Jesus was saying that this is part of what it means to be a human being and follow God. It means to be obedient. That there are things that we are asked to do that we do just because we are asked. There are reasons to do them as well, but even if we don't understand all the reasons, we do it anyway. Obedience is a word that is, I think, mostly misunderstood by us. Obedience is not considered a positive word, or at least it doesn't have a lot of positive connotations for many of us. We don't describe ourselves as obedient workers in the office, because it seems to send the wrong message. And that's unfortunate, because obedience doesn't mean that you've been squashed. Obedience doesn't mean servile. Obedience means that you do what you need to do. You do what you've been asked to do by someone who has a right to ask it. We ask our children to be obedient because we are convinced, and rightly so, that we know what they need to do. We ask them to go to bed at a particular time because we know better than they do. Jesus was obedient. He wasn't servile. Jesus did what the call of him, the call that was on him as a human being, fully divine at the same time in the mystery of the incarnation, to be sure. But Jesus didn't say, I'm fundamentally different from the rest of you, which of course he was, so I don't have to do that. Jesus said, this is part of following God. So I'm going to. No partiality means no partiality. There is nothing that we can go through that Jesus didn't go through as well. Not necessarily in detail. We've talked about that before. Jesus didn't have to deal with cars and things, but he dealt with all the things that matter the same way we did. We do. Jesus didn't get an easier road because he was fully divine. There was no partiality, no favoritism demonstrated towards Jesus, which makes it so much easier for us, not always easy, but easier to do what Jesus has called us to do because he went first. He opened the way. He's a guide, not someone who just stands at the back and tells us what to do. He's a coach, not an owner. In sports teams, owners say, I want a championship. Coach says, this is how we're going to do it. A coach helps the team through. That's what we want. And that's what we have in Jesus. And one of the ways he demonstrated that, because he couldn't demonstrate everything, Jesus never demonstrated how to drive and not suffer from road rage. Didn't have a car. He couldn't do that. But there are lots of things that are exactly the same. Obedience, demonstrated in the form of baptism, something that we've done. That's exactly the same for us. And so when Jesus asks us to do things, he asks us from the perspective of somebody who says, I know what this is like. I know what it can cost. I know what it feels like. But I want you to do it anyway. We follow someone who knows us because he was us. We follow someone who has gone through what we've gone through and more besides, and says, you can do it because I know you can. I know what it's like. I did it myself and I have confidence in you. That's a wonderful message. When you're helping your kids learn how to swim, to jump off the edge of the pool, to be able to tell them, I remember when I was a little worried about jumping off the edge of the pool, but I did it and it was fun. It was scary at first, but I figured it out. That's completely different than saying, well, I've heard other people enjoy this, so go ahead. With Jesus, who makes many demands on us. Let's not ignore those. The Sermon on the Mount is hard to follow. But Jesus says, I want you to do this because I know you can. And I've shown you how. When we follow Jesus, we follow someone who isn't from looking at us from a viewpoint that says, the theory suggests that you can accomplish this. He says, I know you can do this. I've done it myself. I know what it'll cost you. But I'll be with you there. And I know you can do it. Jesus got baptized not for him, but for us. So that we would know that he entered fully into all it means to be human. And that when we follow him, we follow somebody who understands us completely.